Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Dr. Tony Eitan, grew up in Montreal, Canada, a country with a strong social contract. He said he felt nurtured by that city. Canada provides universal health care, universal child care benefits, paid vacation and guaranteed sick leave, high-quality community resources like state-of-the-art public transportation, and highly subsidized post-secondary education. He says he went to university basically for free. When he graduated from college, he was told that Johns Hopkins was the best medical school in the world. And when he landed there, he was elated. And then someone gave him a tour of East Baltimore, and he was shocked. He saw dilapidated buildings, neglected neighborhoods, and very few resources for the community. And that led him to ask, what is the American social contract? Does it even exist? What happened to social benefit policies? Well, this has turned into his life's work. He argues that in order to improve public health, we need a healthy social contract. Dr. Tony Eitan is now Senior Vice President for Healthy Communities at the California Endowment, where he oversees a 10-year, multi-million dollar statewide commitment to advance policies and forge partnerships to build healthy communities in California. Dr. Eitan previously served as Director for the Alameda County Public Health Department, and that is actually the last time we had him on the show. Dr. Eitan joins us in studio. Hi, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, I really appreciate your focus on the social contract. And before we dive in and talk about that, I think it's important to talk about your upbringing and just what your experience was like in Canada.
Well, as many of your listeners will probably know, Canada is it's a large country with a small population. It's got about the same population as California. But it's a country that invests in its people. It's made basic decisions that there are benefits that we all need because we all will inevitably stumble in our lives, whether it's a health crisis, losing a job, having a car accident, what have you. And so there are, essentially there's a safety net that allows people to essentially stumble but then get back up and pursue opportunity. And so I grew up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Canada. You know, I was a black kid. I was actually born in the States and grew up in Canada. So I was a black American kid with two black American brothers growing up in that time period. And, you know, we really felt like we were cared for. There was universal health care, as you mentioned. There was universal dental care in Quebec for children that we all benefited from. My parents, you know, were university professors, and my mom was a nurse. And so, you know, we paid fairly high taxes, you know, in retrospect. And, you know, certainly Canadians don't love paying taxes. But the benefits that you get, you don't feel like if you lose your job, you're going to lose your health care. You don't feel like, you know, if you get into a car accident, you're going to be bankrupted. That just doesn't even come into the equation. So there's a security that you have that you can pursue education without having to go bankrupt. I remember watching television back in the old days and hearing American television talk about, oh, you've got to put away money for college. You know, you've got to have a college savings account. And I'd ask my parents, I'm like, do we have a college savings account? And they'd be like, no, college is basically free. And so, you know, there were just these differences that, you know, you sort of took as normal. And so it was a very nurturing environment in which to grow up.
You also talk about resources like state-of-the-art public transportation, open space, public parks.
Yeah, well, one of the things in retrospect, I go back to Canada a lot because my parents are still there, and I notice in Canada there are people at the bus stops. I mean, like lots of people, you know, waiting for the metro, people walking. There's just a much higher dependence on public transportation and essentially healthy ways of getting around as opposed to sitting in a car all the time. In California, it's a rare thing to see a lot of people at the bus stop. Mm. You might see it in San Francisco, but you don't see it in, you know, outside of the sort of really dense urban city. So people who take the bus are generally perceived as, you know, being of a stature that they can't afford to essentially have a car, or they're dependent on, you know, these long routes that they have to take in order to get to their jobs. Whereas in Canada, you know, it's expected that people will use public transportation. So there's an investment in public transportation, and it's well connected, and, you know, it's subsidized. So lots of people use it. And it's a big difference that you see just walking the streets. That there are people on the streets waiting for the bus, you know, taking their bike to the bus. It feels very natural there as opposed to here.
As someone who grew up in Canada, what are your thoughts about the conversations around health care in this country? Because people like Bernie Sanders, they bring down doctors from Canada to say, can you share what it's like? And we've all, or a lot of us, have seen that little card that you have.
Right.
And then you have people who say, oh, no, but the lines are too long. People from Canada come down here for specialized services because they have to wait. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I actually have been in Senator Sanders' office and been on his little radio program talking about this experience of, you know, coming from Canada into the United States. And I've been in the United States for over 30 years. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm as American as it comes now. But I think that the fundamental difference is the not having the insecurity. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in this country. I often say that, you know, the phrase universal health care, the important part of that phrase is the universal part. It's a sense that everybody belongs, everybody's taken care of, you know, we're all equal. It's not so much the health care, because as we know, health care is, you know, only responsible for about 10 to 15% of our health. So health care is important, but it's not sufficient to actually generate health. So living in Canada, because of that social contract, you don't feel that worry, that stress, that something's going to happen to you as you do here. And the conversation here has been exclusively about how do we pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about, you know, I like to say that health care is an expenditure. Health is an investment. And Canada invests in health so that you don't have to expend lots of money on health care. We do not invest in health. And therefore, we spend twice the average of, you know, developed countries on health care. And it's still insufficient, and it's growing at a rate that's out of control.
You mentioned taxes, and when I was reading about your childhood and growing up in Canada, it reminded me of a conversation I had with a man I met a couple years ago who makes a pretty decent living in Canada. He's pretty wealthy. And I asked him, how much do you pay in taxes? And he said, about 45%. And I said, how do you feel about that? And he said, well, I get together with my rich friends and we complain about it. But at the end of the day, we realize that we need a strong social contract.
Yeah.
Because we need to make sure that our people are healthy, somewhat healthy, that they have a social safety net. And I was just struck by that. Now, this is common sense, but you just rarely hear that in a lot of the conversations in this country. It's always, how do you pay for it? How do you pay for it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you can draw a line and say, look, there's some things that we do better collectively as a society. You know, if we want to pave the streets, we've got to collect taxes and everybody's got to chip in to pave the streets. If you want a police department, you got to chip in and pay for the police department. Same with fire, same with the military, you know, same with basic things that we all need. In Canada, we recognize that basic things that we all need includes health care and includes education. So we all chip in and pay for those things. Whereas in this country, to go to college, you've got to start saving when the kid is born. And even with that, you still have people taking on enormous debt just to afford an undergraduate degree. Healthcare, you know, we've got millions of people uninsured still despite the Affordable Care Act and all the improvements that that has brought. And this notion that, you know, somehow healthcare should be a privilege as opposed to a right. Well, Canada draws that line differently. You know, we don't say here, you know, you should pay privately for fire services in your neighborhood, or you should pay privately for police services in your privately for the roads. But we do say you should pay privately for healthcare, and you should pay privately for education. That's just a drawing the line at a different place than most other developed countries in the world.
And what about taxes in Canada? How is that communicated? Because what's kind of shocking about what's happening in the United States, and I just wish that this gets more attention, is that the taxes have really flipped. So in the 60s, corporations paid most of the taxes, and now we pay. Middle-class people pay most of the taxes. CBS and others just reported that corporate America is paying its lowest share of taxes since Eisenhower. So CEO pay is off the charts, to the point where the New York Times said, we don't even have room for all the zeros the other day. And then you've got profits that are off the charts. Can you talk about those differences and what, since you have a really interesting vantage point here?
Well, the Republicans will point out that Canada has had, up until recently, after the tax cut reforms that were done, Canada had a lower corporate tax rate than the United States. But Canada actually, people pay their taxes. I mean, the U.S., the number of corporations that actually have zero taxes at the end of the year because of all these tax shelters and dodges is substantial. I mean, the richest countries in the world, companies in the world, Apple and various others, pay like zero to Amazon, pay zero taxes despite the tax rate. So even with the tax rate, there's not a lot of corporate tax paying going on at the higher echelons. So I think that, this notion of corporations essentially driving the economy is a little bit of a falsehood. I mean, it's working people who drive the economy. And this country did best when we had a strong middle class. And that's what Canada has. It invests in its middle class, not just in its, corporate barons. It invests in the people who actually do the work, the people who make up the bulk of the population. The U.S. has stopped doing that, for decades now. And the middle class is shrinking. And quite frankly, we're seeing dramatic health consequences here, particularly in the white working class.
Right. And we'll talk about that. Okay, so you grew up in Canada, and we're learning about all of the social services and the contract that is in Canada. And then after you graduated from college, you were told that Johns Hopkins in Baltimore was the best medical school in the world, and you were just elated to land there. And then someone gave you a tour of the city. Right. What happened when you drove through East Baltimore?
Well, there's this saying at Johns Hopkins that is, we may not be the best, but there's nobody better. And so this notion that, Hopkins is this sort of like it's really kind of the citadel of health in the United States is pervasive. People feel it there. And, as I was being toured around East Baltimore by an upperclassman, I was seeing scenes that looked to me like a war zone. I couldn't understand what I was seeing. There were burnt out houses, cars that were up on jacks, weeds growing up through the sidewalks, rodents all over the place, garbage piled up to people's knees, and babies playing in and amongst this. This is right immediately adjacent to Johns Hopkins Hospital. And I could not understand what I was seeing. And the person who was touring me around saw this look of just like confusion on my face. And he said, what's wrong? And all I could manage to stammer out was something like, when was there a war here? And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, with his look of utter disdain, he said, what'd you expect? It's the inner city. And I thought, oh my God, this is an expectation in the United States. This is a norm. This is something that is accepted and it's been named. And, since that time, I've been going back to Canada looking for the inner city in Canada. I've been in every province. I ask people to take me to the worst part of town, and I can't find it. There are no inner cities of the type that you find in Baltimore and all over the United States. In Canada, you just don't have them. You have poor neighborhoods, but you don't see burnt-out buildings, cars up on jacks, babies running around. I mean, you see, I remember I was being toured around in Hamilton, Ontario, and when one of the people touring me around said, this is our worst neighborhood. And I saw kids out jogging and playing hacky sack in the park and the big, beautiful parks. And I said, how is this a bad neighborhood? And the person looked at me and said, well, we have a lot of renters here. Hmm. And that was like as bad as it gets.
Hmm. After you saw East Baltimore, did you talk to your colleagues at Johns Hopkins about this? How did they respond?
Yeah, I did. People thought, the international students understood me. They were like, we did not think America was this. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were as shocked as I was. And some of the other, few Canadians that were there were kind of like, yeah, I don't know what the heck is going on here. But the Americans, they were like, meh, yeah, we got this all over the place. This is how we roll. In fact, many of our best healthcare institutions are located in these so-called inner cities. You have the Cleveland Clinic, you've got USC Hospital, obviously Hopkins. I mean, you've got them all over the country, and then they seem to attract, I don't know why, these neighborhoods that just sort of fall into disrepair. And the ability of that institution to improve the health of that community is almost inverse.
Hmm. You, in a TED Talk, you said that when you saw children in the clinics at Johns Hopkins, you wondered, what would have happened to me if I had grown up in East Baltimore? Would I have grown up and gone to Johns Hopkins to become a doctor?
Right. Well, I mean, so the irony is, you know, I look at kids, I looked at kids back in those days in those neighborhoods, and I thought, you know, these kids didn't build this neighborhood, no more than I built the environment that I grew up in Canada. I mean, I didn't create the universal healthcare system or, you know, universal dental care or child care or, you know, the public, state-of-the-art public transportation. These kids didn't blight these communities. You know, they didn't strip resources away. Yet they have to navigate that environment every single day of their lives. This is their world. And kids are not stupid. They internalize that. They see that the message that they're getting is that you're not valued. You don't matter. You have no worth. And they internalize that. You see that turning into this rage, you know, as they go into their teen years. And as they go into adulthood, you actually see what I saw, and I couldn't understand, because so many people in Baltimore wouldn't make eye contact. They would sort of look away. And I found myself always trying to catch somebody's gaze because I couldn't understand why they wouldn't look at me. And I realized that this was this sense of hopelessness, a sense of futurelessness that had like the light in their eyes had been extinguished by constant despair and disappointment and the reminder that they weren't valued.
Hmm. Have you been back?
Oh, I go back every year. There's a social determinants of health conference there.
Okay. And so what is it like now? I mean, it's interesting because I was at Johns Hopkins moderating a discussion. And when I checked into the hotel, I was wanting to ask about The Wire, but I thought maybe people are so tired of it. But yeah. I did anyway. I said, I'm just curious. This guy grew up there. And I said, what did you think of The Wire, which was this great HBO series? And he said, oh, I was a kid when they shot it in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. He said, I loved it. And I said, what has changed since then? He said, nothing. Yeah. There are very few jobs for kids coming out of the neighborhood, very few resources. A lot of the kids are still hanging out on the corners. And, you know, here's a new hotel, and I got this job working at the front desk, checking people in. But it's hard to get these kinds of jobs.
Yeah. Baltimore has gentrified a lot in around the Inner Harbor and in other parts of town that were actually pretty run down when I was there. But in East Baltimore and West Baltimore, where you had the Freddie Gray uprising, that has not changed. That's to my mind, that has stayed exactly the same, if not gotten a little bit worse. I mean, the Freddie Gray episode, you know, showed you, you know, and Time Magazine had a full story on, you know, Baltimore from 1968 to, you know, 2015, what's changed. And they argued that nothing has really changed. You still have fundamental disinvestment and, you know, as great a degree of inequity as you can really find in the United States.
Today, we are speaking with Dr. Tony Eitan, Senior Vice President for Healthy Communities at the California Endowment, where he oversees a 10-year, multi-million-dollar statewide commitment to advance policies and forge partnerships to build healthy communities in California. Dr. Eitan previously served as the director for the Alameda County Public Health Department. And we would love to hear from you. If you grew up in a country with a strong social contract, give us a call and let us know about it. And what changes did you experience when you came to the United States? 866-798-8255. And then what are your thoughts about what it will take to actually create a stronger social contract in this country? If you have experience with any public health, social services, proposals being made in your area, we would love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. I think what's one of the arguments you make is really important because there's so much attention on healthcare. You say that it's important to point out that about 80% of what influences our lives happens outside of the healthcare system.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a medical doctor, you know, I walk around in a stethoscope periodically, you know, wearing a stethoscope and a white jacket. And I have realized, just looking at the data, that there's the influence that I have on somebody's health is relatively modest. I can pull them back from the brink. There's no question about that. But the question is, you know, how do they get to the brink? And getting from, you know, health to sort of like the brink of a crisis is really driven by society. It's about opportunity. And all of those risks that we encounter on a day-to-day basis that in some people's lives are just cumulative and synergistic. They're facing risks in their jobs. They're facing risks in their neighborhood. They're facing risks in just virtually every aspect of their life. And they have very few resources. And what a social contract does is it helps balance the risks and resources. We know we're all going to face risks and challenges in our lives. The only question is, what kind of resources do we have at our disposal to be able to essentially manage those risks? And so in countries that have a strong social contract, you can get an education without going bankrupt. You can get access to health care when you get sick. You can get, you know, from A to B in public transportation to get to a job. You know, so all of these basic things that allow you to essentially manage those risks that are happening in your life allow you to be healthier for longer in your life. And as a consequence, places like Canada have a substantially longer life expectancy than the United States.
And the life expectancy in the United States, it's kind of shocking to read that it's going down.
It's in decline. It's 3 years in a row it's been in decline. And the last time that happened was 1918, like 100 years ago, around World War I and a global pandemic of flu. So this is an unprecedented decline in health status in this country that should be raising alarm bells at the highest levels of our government.
You know, you have politicians on both sides say that, you know, as long as you can pursue your passions, you can do anything in this country, right? You hear that pretty regularly during especially the presidential debates. And as you point out, in this country, low-income people are physiologically different from high-income people, specifically because of policies.
Yeah, and you know, that's a provocative statement, and it's meant to be a provocative statement, and it's true. And what happens is that when you live in a place like East Baltimore, you're exposed to stressors, chronic stressors. You know, you're exposed to crime. Your housing is poor quality. You can't find a job. You can't find health care. You may not even be able to find potable water, clean drinking water. I mean, that's not an unusual thing in many of our cities. Look at Flint, Michigan. So you're constantly juggling stressors. You're trying to manage your limited opportunity through all of these different risks. And what that does is it creates cortisol in your body, which circulates constantly. And cortisol has a profound effect on your physiology, independent of your behavior. You can be a marathoner that, you know, is a vegan. And if you're living in highly stressful environments, your body will change physiologically. You'll develop cardiovascular disease. You'll develop the precursors to type 2 diabetes. You'll develop immune system problems. And you actually have changes in your brain that make it less easy for you to engage in what we call executive function, which is really the ability to make good decisions facing a lot of different options. And so I've started saying, and it's meant to be provocative, that low-income people and high-income people in this country are physiologically different, not because they were born that way, but because we made them that way through policy, or more often, it's the absence of policy in the face of abject need, the absence of a social contract.
You reminded me of a show we did with some young girls and women who live in the Bayview, which is just 10 minutes, 5 minutes from this station. And they talked about just being afraid of going to the bus stop, walking to school because their backpack might be stolen or something could happen. They also hear shots. And so how, in a mature society, we would be able to talk about the complexities of why that happens, mm-hmm. why there is crime in a neighborhood, you know, as the result of poverty and very low access to fresh fruits and vegetables, dilapidated buildings, not many resources. In a mature society, we could talk about that. But it's hard to get there sometimes in this society. Instead, we say, well, who stole the backpack? Let's put them in jail.
Right.
Right? So can you talk about how we get there? Because it's so incredibly important.
Well, that's a great question, Rose. And I think that at its root, folks like you who, you know, spend time on the radio and help shape the narrative in this country are really important in this regard, because we live in a country where there are competing narratives. There's one narrative, which our president is an expert at, which is a narrative of exclusion, which basically says that there are some people who are less deserving than others, and they are trying to steal, you know, resources from us, and they're trying to make our future scary and unpredictable. And then there's a narrative of inclusion, which basically says, look, you know, we all do better when we all do better, and we're inextricably intertwined in our well-being. And if we don't work together, we're going to have a much worse time of it. And by the way, historically, there hasn't been a level playing field. We come out of an apartheid system, you know, where people were essentially pushed to areas where they, you know, were deprived of resources.
Exactly.
And at the end of the day, race and racism is the fundamental issue in this country that has kind of injured our ability to construct a social contract and create this notion of shared solidarity across groups.
And moved to different places. You just reminded me, NPR had a great piece this morning, and I hope you all can listen to this. We'll put a link after the show. It's called "For Many Navajos, Getting Hooked Up to the Power Grid Can Be Life-Changing." Netta Billy has been waiting to turn on her lights in her home for 15 years.
Wow.
10% of Navajos on the reservation live without electricity. 40% have to haul their water and use outhouses. This is in 2019.
Yeah.
And she just got electricity because some very nice people decided to volunteer to hook it up.
Well, one of the most shocking experiences for me happened in California, up on the Hoopa Reservation in Northern California, where we have communities that still to this day don't have electricity or running water, where people are essentially using batteries to run their washing machines. This is in California today.
Dr. Tony Eitan is Senior Vice President for Healthy Communities at the California Endowment, and we will talk about this program after the break. He's overseen a 10-year, multi-million-dollar statewide commitment to advance policies to actually build healthy communities, and he has a lot of positive stories to share about people coming together to improve their lives and their communities. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with artists performing at the San Francisco International Arts Festival and hear how immigration policies have impacted the festival. This year, a Syrian theater company and a Canadian dance ensemble will not be making their U.S. debuts because they were refused visas. And then we learned that at this festival, they were going to have a conversation about visas, and a few people on the panel were denied visas. They said this has never happened before. So we're going to talk about that tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are speaking with Dr. Tony Eitan about what it will take to strengthen the social contract in the United States. And that is really the only way that we will truly address our public health crisis. Dr. Tony Eitan served as director for the Alameda County Public Health Department, and he's now Senior Vice President for Healthy Communities at the California Endowment, where he oversees a 10-year, multi-million-dollar statewide commitment to advance policies to build healthy communities. And he has amazing stories, which we will hear about. But first, let's take a few phone calls. Let's go to Anne in Mountain View. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, this is a hard comment to make, but you know, I think one of the biggest barriers to our getting universal health care in this country is that people are putting too little effort into understanding how that might happen. I think people on the left are very tied to the idea that it has to be single payer, and I think that's never going to fly with anybody on the right. I also believe that, you know, choice is very important as a quality control mechanism. So I think we should be looking more at economies that are more similar to ours, like Germany and Japan, where they don't use single payer; they use all nonprofit health insurance. I think there's a very compelling argument that T.R. Reid made in his book, The Healing of America, that it's having even some for-profit health insurance distorts things so that you end up with these really, really high costs. There's this fundamental conflict between paying for people's health care and paying investors. So people think the denials are to save money and that having private companies to make those denials will make it more efficient. But the thing is, they profit as a percentage of the healthcare economy. So their duty to their investors is to keep that healthcare economy high. So the denials, i.e. the 30% of every healthcare dollar we spend on paperwork, is largely because of for-profit health insurance. It's not helping us to create an efficient product and something that works well for everybody. And, you know, that's my second comment, is that we've really lost this sense of pragmatism to an ideology that was really born in the 80s. When I was younger, you know, you go to Europe, and Europe was falling apart, and they weren't making the investments in the public infrastructure. And here, everything was shiny and new, and the roads and the streets and the schools. And, I mean, let's talk about the kids and their health. You know, schools in this country, the majority of them were built in the 50s or before. And there's all kinds of research that shows you have negative lots of negative outcomes related to the age of the facilities, and we're just not making the investments. I think we need to change the narrative around how these things are paid for, so that the companies that have benefited, the individuals who have benefited the most from past investments by the public, you know, the roads and the ports and the judicial system and the safety system and telecommunications and on and on and on, that they're paying back. It's not about taxing them. It's about now they're successful using these public investments. They need to pay back.
Well, Anne, thank you for your comment. Let's get a response from Dr. Eitan. What are your thoughts about her comments about how the universal healthcare system is too focused on single payer?
Yeah, well, I think she makes some good points. I mean, I want to clarify something that I think is a frequent kind of misconception in healthcare, this notion of choice. And, you know, in single, the choice that people want to make is a choice of doctor. You know, it's not so much a choice of health plan. Health plan is just a way of paying for the doctor. What you want is to be able to see the doctor that you have a good relationship with or has the particular skill set that you need or the institution that you want to, you know, go to because you trust it and you believe in it. And single payer gives you unlimited choice. You can go to any doctor or any hospital or any health facility that you want because they all take your insurance. And we conflate this notion of choice of insurance product with choice of doctor, and that's a mistake. You know, so having a lot of different insurance products is just confusing for people. I mean, they have to essentially read through all this fine print and compare apples to oranges half the time. So I do agree that choice is important, but let's be clear about what we want a choice of. We want a choice of provider, not per se a choice of convoluted insurance products. I mean, who likes to read car insurance products to compare? You don't want to read all that stuff. That's confusing.
Right.
The other thing I think that Anne's right about is a competition is good in a health system. And you just want competition over the right things. You want competitions over quality. You want not competitions over essentially shrouded costs. And that's what you have right now. It's like, you know, people sort of sell you a false, you know, bill of goods. And then once you get into that insurance product, you find out all these things that you can't get access to. So you don't have transparency in the market. We have no idea how much healthcare costs at a hospital. A Band-Aid can be anywhere from 15 cents to $30. You hear all these crazy – you don't have a real market. So the idea that you can actually participate, you know, meaningfully in a market where you don't have good information is just false. So I agree with her that the profit issue is a fundamental issue in this country, and we have to get to the root of that. But I think that we have to be clear about what we're looking for choice of. We're looking for choice of provider, not choice of insurance product.
Well, thank you for the call, Anne. We have an email from Helen who says, I moved here in the 80s from England and still remember how shocked I was hearing someone on the radio talking about having to decide between buying food and taking their child to the doctor. Tyrone in Oakland could not stay on, but he wanted to say, I grew up in Vienna, Austria. Even over there, we have a strong social contract. But over here, we can't even talk about the social contract. How can we have that conversation with people who don't get it, like Trump supporters, for example?
Well, the interesting thing is when you read the Declaration of Independence, you very quickly realize that the Declaration of Independence was based on a social contract. I mean, it was based on continental philosophers who talked about this fundamental agreement between the governed and the government. And that is that we are governed by the consent of the people. In order for you to govern us, we have to agree that you're providing for our basic needs. And the minute that we recognize that you're not providing for our basic needs, we reserve the right to overthrow you. That's what the Declaration of Independence says, and it's based on this notion of consent. So social contract is as American as apple pie. It's not a socialism. I mean, just because the word social is in there doesn't mean that it's socialism. I wish Americans would spend a little bit more time, you know, engaging in critical thinking and thinking about, you know, essentially, you know, what are the fundamental precepts of this country? And you recognize that the social contract is as fundamental as America.
I put my head in my hands because you hear some of these hosts like Chuck Todd on Meet the Press ask these presidential candidates, are you a capitalist? It's like, what does that mean? Are you a socialist? What does that mean? I mean, this is, if this is a preview of what's to come, It's going to be a pretty ugly year.
I like to point out Canada is a capitalist country. Sweden is a capitalist country. Denmark is a capitalist country. Norway is a capitalist country. And they all have universal health care and strong social contracts. So we just, and the word capitalism doesn't occur in the Constitution anywhere. We have conflated the notion of capitalism and democracy, which is, again, a failure of our critical thinking skills.
Yes. Well, thank you for those emails. Let's go next to Joanne in San Francisco. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to the show. Do we have Joanne? Hello, Joanne.
Oh, yes. Hi. I'm sorry. I was on mute. Hi.
Oh, okay.
It's so good to hear this conversation. And one of the things as an English person that I've found is that it's very difficult, as somebody just said, to have this conversation because I believe that there is a sort of underlying assumption that America is better than anywhere else, and that's the end of it. I'm very grateful that I now live in San Francisco because I became ill about 10 years ago, too ill for work, and lost everything. And because of healthy San Francisco, have been able to get back to fully working. And I always thought, what a pointless waste it would have been if I, as a $100,000 a year earning person, should have ended up homeless and on the street. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not even just people who, come from poor neighborhoods or whatever, I don't know, but just that without that safety net, people just can get lost all the time. And obviously, the poorer and the less educated, the faster that can happen. But as people have brought up, it's just devastating to think of people having to choose between something like healthcare and food. And I think that another piece I see is that in America, the acceptance, and this is what the doctor was talking about, the acceptance of unbelievable poverty and lives of horror is somehow accepted in this country in a way that would never be accepted in Canada or America or Austria or Sweden. And my Republican friends keep saying that healthcare is an undermining that socialists, i.e. communists, use to infiltrate democratic societies, but it's absolutely a lie. And those narratives, I feel as though, we have to do our best to be able to change them. But the acceptance, the tolerance of the evils of poverty seem to me to be where we can start addressing it. I may not be being very articulate because I'm so passionate about it.
No, you're very articulate, Anne. Thank you so much. And, thank you, Anne, for sharing your story. And I'm so glad that Healthy SF was there for you. And for people who live out of the area, Healthy San Francisco is basically designed to make healthcare available and affordable to people who do not have insurance. And I'm on the website right now, and it looks like now they have changed the qualifications, so they've expanded Healthy SF. The income eligibility is now for people who make up to $54,000 a year. So if you make $54,000 or less and you don't have insurance, definitely go to healthysanfrancisco.org and hopefully they can help you out. So thank you so much for calling in, Anne. You know, what about that, Dr. Eitan? There are programs in different states across the country like this that do have a strong safety net, so people like Anne do not become homeless. And I also want to mention that just yesterday we learned that in San Francisco there's going to be a universal mental health care proposition on the November ballot, which is so also important in this city and across the country, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, Joanne made a couple of good points. I mean, one is that it's not just low-income people that are struggling with health care, and anybody can be, experience a catastrophic illness, or not even a catastrophic illness, a chronic disease where the pharmaceuticals are really expensive and your insurance, caps out after a certain point, and it can actually lead to bankruptcy. A third of all people who develop cancer in this country within 2 years essentially spend their entire life savings. It's that is the American way. So I think Healthy San Francisco is a fantastic response to essentially a pretty poor set of options. It's very hard to construct a healthcare system without federal support because you have all kinds of federal laws. You've got Medicare, you've got Medicaid, and the control of the purse strings of those is, you know, largely in Washington, D.C., although Medicaid has some influence at the state level. So Mitch Katz, who was the health director here for many years and is a friend of mine, with some very creative people, decided to construct Healthy San Francisco out of what they could use, which were the hospitals and institutions around the city that were there and the various investments that San Francisco had made in healthcare. They decided to consolidate that all into one system, which creates some significant efficiencies and allow people to take advantage of those systems to improve their health. So it's not a health insurance plan per se. Mm. It's a health access plan, which was a brilliant response to, as I said, a set of relatively difficult options. And San Francisco as a city and county is uniquely situated to be able to do that. It's harder for a place like Alameda County, which has 18 cities in it, to be able to do something like that. But I tip my hat to the leadership in San Francisco.
Well, thank you again for calling in and sharing your story, Joanne. Before we talk about a lot of the positive changes that you're seeing and working with, I wanted to ask you just about where we are right now, because, you know, people of color are disproportionately impacted by health burdens. We talked about no electricity on the Navajo Nation, pollution. We've got women dying of pregnancy. We talk about that on this show. But now it's affecting a broader swath of the population. So it's not just poor people and people of color. In 2017, the results of a study released in a report for the California Endowment showed what researchers called a, quote, health crisis of white death in poor counties. But we are also seeing this across the country in middle-class white areas.
Yeah. So this, I think, is the culmination of the lack of a social contract. And it's the inability to create essentially these programs that are universal for everybody. And, you know, we could go deeper into sort of the motivation of that and the history of that. A lot of that has to do with racism. But the reality is that there is sort of this boomerang effect that, you know, policies that are targeted at low-income people of color or people of color in general, blacks, Latinos, Native Americans, you know, the absence of, you know, health insurance policies, education support policies, of, you know, housing policies, those are all intentionally targeted at people of color historically. If you just do the analysis, you just see it. And the effect of that now is kind of coming back on vulnerable white populations, which you see that throughout American history. It's just that now you're seeing this crisis, what some researchers are calling deaths of despair, which is white, middle and working class people, and disproportionately women, surprisingly, not men. I mean, it's affecting both men and women, but more so women, are now dying at rates that are unprecedented. We're actually seeing more excess death in the white population than the entire U.S. HIV/AIDS epidemic. It's over 500,000 excess deaths. It's an epidemic of unprecedented scale in the United States. It's driving down our life expectancy. And it's largely self-inflicted. It's alcohol-related organ disease or, you know, alcoholic-related death, drugs, overdose, and suicide. Mm. And it's overwhelmingly white, American, disproportionately rural population. So we studied that in California, and we found that there are 28 counties that are experiencing a white mortality epidemic, an epidemic of premature white death. And interestingly, of those 28 counties in California, 25 of them voted for the current president. So we think it may be an epidemiologic phenomenon driving a political phenomenon. And we think it's an existential crisis for this country.
And is one of the main problems that it's just so difficult to get access to health care and mental health care?
I think it has to do with true despair, where people's expectations are very high and their reality is very low. And that gap between their expectations and reality is large and growing. And, you know, so the question is, are the expectations too high or is the reality too low? I would argue that the reality is too low And part of the reality being low is that people can't find living wage jobs. They can't find a good way to get education, to advance their careers. The economies are being extracted from those rural communities. And so you see this real split in California where the coastal whites are doing very well, but the rural and Central Valley whites are doing very poorly. They're literally like two different countries. So I think that fundamentally, this is the manifestation of a lack of a social contract.
And see, this, when you talk about the Trump supporter and the, quote, angry white man, which is what we hear in the media, this is where the media should really go and research.
I do not understand for the life of me, Rose, why we haven't actually put the question to that voter about what are the policies that you see that would improve your lot. Because I think at the end of the day, they would say the same thing that I'm saying.
Yes.
But we haven't put that question to them in a meaningful way and held the president and his administration accountable for investing in those policies.
Let's spend our last couple minutes talking about the California Endowment, and I would love to have you back with some of the community organizers that you're working with on this. So this is an initiative called Building Healthy Communities. It's a 10-year, $1 billion project launched in 2010 to advance policies, basically to create healthy communities at the end of the day, right? And you have some amazing success stories. Let's just go over a couple. So Fresno, California, one of the poorest congressional districts in the United States, the people who are there, the immigrants, a lot of undocumented people, feed the world. These are farm workers. And in 2014, the Board of Supervisors wanted to cut off health care to 5,600 low-income undocumented people, many of whom are farm workers. How did the community respond to that?
Oh, it was such a beautiful thing, Rose. Let me tell you, because of the organizing that we've invested in there in Fresno, and we believe that health is a combination of three things. We call it the ABCs. A is for agency. Agency just means power, the ability to work individually and collectively to make the change that you see as being important. B stands for belonging, which we think is the opposite of racism. It's being seen, being heard in your full humanity, having your culture, having your individuality appreciated, and not being essentially denigrated based on who you are. Mm-hmm. And C is about working on fundamental conditions, like social contract. And we recognize that, you know, I like to say that, you know, in this country, we celebrate people beating the odds, but we rarely recognize the need to change the odds. And that's what this work is about, is to actually create meaningful opportunity for people. And in Fresno, because of the investment we did in organizing, people came together and they said, we're not going to stand for this Board of Supervisors cutting off health care access to the most vulnerable population in California, low-income, non-English-speaking, largely undocumented farm workers who feed us. And so people got together, they organized, they showed up at the Board of Supervisors in a show of force. They said, we're not going to stand for this. And quite frankly, they used the political process to essentially push back on the Board of Supervisors, and they drove the Board of Supervisors back on that decision. And now Fresno County continues to pay for that health care for this population. There is no way that that would have happened without the organizing that was supported by Building Healthy Communities. And that's one of now 1,000 stories.
Wow.
That we have over 10 years of people essentially organizing, fighting back, and creating meaningful opportunity.
You have another great one in Coachella, which is known nationwide for the yearly music festival. I'm sure that a lot of people do not realize that 150,000 residents do not have access to safe drinking water there. And they organized and changed the way the water districts hold their elections, and they have an opportunity to improve their infrastructure.
Exactly. They went from these at-large elections to regional or district elections. Now they have their own representative, and now the system is investing in infrastructure for their own water systems, which was never happened before until they organized themselves and brought these challenges, you know, to the powers that be. And I want to point out, this is health. Mm. This is what health is about. It's about agency, belonging, and changing conditions. Not having access to potable drinking water is as fundamental an unhealthy condition as we know.
I definitely want to have you back with some community members. You work in Long Beach, in other parts of the state, and obviously this information is useful for people across the country. But we just got one email in, and I think this is really important to read. Janet writes, people wonder how kids can grow up to commit crimes. It's simple. We've developed the perfect recipe. Put that kid in a poor community where they can't even eat regularly, where maybe they don't have beds or even a home. Maybe bring them into the world already damaged from alcohol or drugs. Make sure their parents are hooked on street drugs and are unavailable. Add in a lot of violence. Make sure their friends and relatives are murdered in front of them. Sprinkle with a generous dose of hopelessness. Put any kid into that brew and it's unlikely that they'll get out undamaged. This is what I see in my job as a private investigator working with convicted felons. The problem is poverty. I'm preaching to the choir, I know. The problem is unfathomably huge. The solution has to be equally encompassing.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I want to point out that most people that grow up in those communities don't become criminals.
Right.
They become very productive members of our society. And that you have poverty in Canada, you have poverty in Sweden, you have poverty in all of these other Western democracies. The difference in the United States is the social consequences of being poor. When you're poor in this country, it means you don't have health care. It means you're unlikely to be able to go to a good school. It means you're unlikely to be able to find transportation to find a good job. There's a lot of data on that. So being poor is not so much the problem, it's the social consequences. Is how do we create the environment for poverty in this country? And we leave people to incubate in stress in this country.
We'll have you back to talk about these amazing programs. What would you leave listeners with in terms of what is most effective? I mean, we always ask this on the show, but this weekend, there's the California Democratic Convention and 14 of the presidential candidates are coming to town. You know, what is the, they keep asking for money. What is the best way to raise your voice and create change on this issue?
I go back to ABCs. I mean, it's basically we have to change the narrative about who we are as a people. Mm. And we're doing that in California. We've created an inclusive narrative. We're working with populations that have, you know, have been marginalized for so many years. We're bringing them back into the mainstream. California is leading the way.
Dr. Tony Eitan is Senior Vice President for Healthy Communities at the California Endowment, where he oversees a 10-year program to create healthy communities. Can we have you back with some of the community members?
I'd love to. That'd be
to
fun.
To talk about the great work you're
Absolutely.
Doing?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thanks to David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. And if you want to find out more about healthy communities, go to yourcallradio.org, where you can also listen to past shows and podcast our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.